Earlier this month, the U.S. Supreme Court struck down a century-old gun control law in New York, prompting Governor Kathy Hochul and state lawmakers to return to Albany this week for a planned legislative session where new measures addressing firearms could be adopted. Before we look at what new state laws might be added, we wanted to step back in time and consider the backstory for the now defunct Sullivan Law, including getting to know the author of this 1911 statute. To do all that, we're joined on the Capitol Press Room by Terry Galway, an editor with Politico New York, who recently did a deep dive into this bit of history. Welcome to the show, Terry.
Thanks for having me.
So who was Timothy Sullivan, the credited author with the state law recently overturned by the U.S. Supreme Court?
Well, Tim Sullivan was basically, depending on how you want to describe him, he was either a gang leader, a Tammany hack, or to complicate it a little bit more, he was a poor kid who grew up, the children of Irish immigrants. His father died young. He grew up in the Bowery section of Manhattan, took a liking to politics. Tammany took a liking to him. And lo and behold, as a young man, he was elected to the state assembly and then elected to the state senate. He also was a congressperson for a while. He hated Washington, so he came back to serve in the state senate. So he was a complicated a person with a complicated story. You know, the simple description of him in most history books basically is the thuggish aspect of Sullivan. But I've argued for years with middling success that we need to look at these politicos from the early 20th century in maybe a little bit more complicated way, in the sense that they did understand what it was like to be poor. They understand what conditions were like in places like the Bowery. And I feel that many of them, like Tim Sullivan, like Al Smith, you know, actually did something about it once they got into power.
Well, you mentioned that lens of trying to put ourselves in that time period. What should we know about this period of state government and the way it functioned in the early 1900s?
Well, it was a contest between what we would sort of refer to as elites, and the elites back then thought of themselves as progressives, and the sort of the quintessential example of that would be Franklin Roosevelt, sort of a nose in the air reformer who was more interested, in my view, in reforming the habits and customs and lives of the lower classes. And then you sort of had the machine politicians who were not judgmental about people's lives. Tim Sullivan once said, "I don't ask a hungry man whether he's worthy or not of food. I give him food because he's hungry," right? So that with that sort of non-judgmental, transactional, Tammany way of governing. So you had that conflict between the progressives and what you might call the lunch bucket liberals, a conflict that certainly has, you know, some similarities to today.
So what was going on then in 1911, which led Sullivan to champion this gun control issue?
Pistols were commonplace in Manhattan and other urban areas in New York, in Albany and Schenectady, and, you know, in the Great Lakes cities as well. And, you know, depending on which version of history you choose to believe, my version of history is that Sullivan was appalled by the violence. It was very easy to get a pistol on the Bowery, you know, it's a lot harder now and still is a lot harder. Other people have thought that Sullivan very cynically sponsored this law so that his cronies could plant guns on his enemies and get them arrested. And actually some very substantial historians and journalists have bought into that because, in their view, somebody like Tim Sullivan, this roughnecked, corrupt Irish Poll, would be incapable of doing anything so high-minded and progressive as passing a good law. Of course, in my view, Sullivan was reacting to the reality that he saw on the streets, and he tried to ameliorate that.
You mentioned these ideas of cheap pistols. How does the handgun, I guess, of 1911 compare to what we see in 2022 that requires people to try to get a permit for a concealed weapon?
Well, I am no expert on guns. However, I believe that the pistols of 1911 were pretty rudimentary. I'm guessing they probably didn't hit their target very easily, although I wouldn't know. But you know, they were cheap, they were easily made and easily available. And I, again, you know, compared to today, guns in Manhattan are rare compared to the situation that Sullivan and others found themselves in 1911. Lots of cheap weapons that anybody could buy, basically.
You mentioned the opposition to this legislation. It doesn't seem like there was a big Second Amendment concern based on what you wrote in your piece about this time period for Politico. Was that a surprise to you as you researched this issue and the passage of this law? Or is there a reason why the Second Amendment wasn't, I guess, a large part of the conversation at this time?
Yeah, I think the Second Amendment was not a large part of the conversation. I think that historians like myself would agree that the Second Amendment sort of fetish that we see today is a fairly new phenomenon. I think there was more of a consensus 100 years ago about regulating handguns, pistols, than there is today, which is sort of a curious thing. And again, interestingly, there was this well-known sort of progressive-minded journalist in New York, a guy by the name of W.R. Werner, I forget what the initials stand for, but he sort of ghostwrote a lot of progressive-minded journals, articles, and things like that. And it was Werner, in his History of Tammany Hall, who complained that as a result of Big Tim Sullivan, ordinary citizens could not defend themselves from criminals, which is exactly what Samuel Alito said in his opinion from last week.
Do you have a sense of what the consequence was of this statute taking effect? Was it the case that guns were not as commonplace in the immediate aftermath of this, or did it take time for the landscape to change to what we have at least prior to the Supreme Court ruling?
I think it took some time. I mean, I think that once again, in an echo of what you hear about today's debates, you know, law-abiding people probably said, okay, well, according to Big Tim Sullivan, I now have to get a permit for this cheap pistol I have. Whereas others who maybe weren't as scrupulous about following laws did not. So I think it took a while for the Sullivan law to take effect. But, you know, for somebody of my age, and I'm on the verge of retirement or so-called retirement at the age of 66, and, you know, sort of grew up in an age, I mean, I remember reading about the Sullivan law. Now, granted, I was precocious, of course, but I remember reading about the Sullivan law when I was a teenager, you know, in the late 1960s. And it was held up as this model. It was something a New Yorker should be proud of, that New York had the Sullivan. I didn't know anything about Big Tim Sullivan when I was 15, but I knew we had a Sullivan law. And I knew that it was something that made New York different and better. And now we don't have it anymore, which, you know, again, for somebody my age is just sort of astonishing to contemplate.
Well, finally, I'm curious, the process of digging up something like this, it's not like you can turn to an online database to look up voting or get a YouTube video of the floor debate on this issue. So how do you go about finding out this history? What resources do you use, and how much sort of time did you commit to this as you try to piece back this bit of history?
Well, I owe a great debt to other historians, and that is part of my, you know, I wear a journalist hat, I wear a historian's hat, and they don't always fit properly, but that period of New York history is so well documented by so many fabulous historians, because it remains, you know, my later in life obsession too, the period in Albany from basically the governorship of Teddy Roosevelt until the governorship of Tom Dewey. That's sort of been written about by all sorts of historians. So they came first. However, I will say, you know, that wonderful resources like the New York Times Online Archive, which you can get if you're a subscriber, and I am, actually is just fabulous. I mean, again, I'm old enough to remember that to get some of the information I needed for this article and for the books I've written, you had to go to the New York Public Library, in my case, and go through microfilm. Oh my God, microfilm. You may as well be talking about Gutenberg here. Now, with the few strokes of my keyboard, I can get access to the New York Times. And you know, that's how I was able to research some of the background to Tim Sullivan and Tammany Hall and everything else that was going on in New York in 1911. I consider myself lucky that I have these online resources that other historians didn't.
Well, finally, if listeners do want to dive into some of your written works like Machine Made, how can they go about securing these books that you've written in the past?
Well, funny you should ask. Generally, you know, Amazon, and I don't like, you know, sort of advertising a big corporate entity like Amazon, but let's face it, right? If you go on Amazon and you plug in my name, G-O-L-W-A-Y, you'll find not just Machine Made, but sort of a sequel to my History of Tammany Hall called Frank and Al, which is a book about the relationship between Franklin Roosevelt and Al Smith. And again, there's stuff, particularly in Frank and Al, that I think other historians didn't get a chance to see because it meant going through all of those New York Times microfilms, whereas I was able to just get it by going on my computer. So I'm particularly proud of Frank and Al, to be honest.
Well, we've been speaking with Terry Galway. He is an editor with Politico New York. Terry, thank you so much for making the time. I really appreciate it.
Thanks. It was my pleasure.
Capital Press Room, a production of WCNY Connected, Syracuse.